All right. Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a podcast that had a name that was fun and funny, like up until about a month ago, but I already paid for the domain, so we're gonna still call it that. So anyway, We're All Gonna Die is a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled The Rump Roller, and it is about a new book of new and old poems from Christopher Collins called The River is Another Kind of Prayer. And our guest for this episode is someone who knows a little something about the new collection, The River is Another Kind of Prayer. It's author Christopher Collins. And first and foremost, Mr. Collins, do you consent to this phone call being recorded?
I consent, sure.
Fantastic. So now we are no longer doing anything illegal.
Well, not yet,
anyway. The day the podcast is still quite young. So, I guess we just dive in. I, the big part of this podcast is me geeking out on people who do stuff that I like, and we're just going to keep that theme rolling. Even though our name is now perhaps unfortunate. So you have this question, River Knows It is Another Kind of Prayer. It's a book in two parts. There are some great new poems, and then there are some sort of, you know, selected poems from the KTEL Backcott catalog.
Yep.
All in one package. And I think the first thing I really would like to talk about is, especially in the new poems, the thing that I find most impressive about your poetics is the way in which you balance being in the moment and history of place, which I can't make those two moves. And I was wondering if you could talk about that as far as, like, poetic inspiration or sort of artistic goal.
Sure. Probably. I should be able to do that. Let's see if I can. It's interesting that you point out those two things, because that's been an ongoing project probably for the last 25 years of trying to write, is that balance, trying to find that kind of sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess if you notice it and it's happening, it makes me happy. I try to write these poems. I generally don't set out with an endpoint in mind. Rarely do I do that. If I do that, it's usually a poem that gets thrown away. It doesn't work. I like to see where they go. I'll usually start in a place, whether a specific place or just kind of a generic dated place, in a bar or just on the street watching, just someplace kind of flat of detail, and then begin to work inside and embroider all of that in some emotionally meaningful way for myself. Anyway, and hopefully for the
years. And so, that's fascinating to me. So, for you, like, what is the initial spark that of an idea that becomes a poem?
I've been doing this long enough that it's an ingrained habit at this point. It becomes an addiction of sorts, where if you're not doing it, you know, I have a lot of fallow periods where I'm not writing. I'm in one right now. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a claws at the inside of my skull a lot that I'm not doing it, and I need to be doing it. Why am I not doing it? Mm-hmm. Find time and space to do it. So the initial spark is to quell that inner nagging voice. Get that to shut up a bit, so I do it. I try to write it. But as far as the poems go, it can be really anything. Like you said, I don't start with an endpoint in mind. I don't really write narrative poems
mm-hmm.
for the most part. I don't want to know what's going to happen next.
Mm.
So for me, the real draw is where it is.
So then for you, writing is that sort of ruminating on place, and also person is really important, I think.
It's really trying, like you said earlier, balancing those two things. When I first started really writing and identifying as a poet of sorts, back in high school, I was writing really kind of image-heavy, lyrical crap that really had no real basis in reality. They were just strings of words that sounded cool to me. I got slayed by one of my teachers back then. Said, you know, this all sounds really pretty, but I don't care. I'm tired of looking at it. I'm tired of reading. There is no, it's not grounded in any kind of reality, so why expect that about it? And he did that to me in front of a creative writing class with my friends. That my girlfriend at the time was sitting in on. So it hit hard
when
he said that. And it pissed me off. And later, talking to him about that day, said, you know, that could have gone either way. I figured you'd either just stop writing altogether, or you'd just get really angry and come back at me to prove me wrong. And, I was hedging my bets that he'd come back at me. So at that point, I went right back to scratch. I started writing real short kind of Japanese-influenced poetry for several years. I don't think my poems were more than 10 lines. It was very rare for them to be more than 10 lines, more than 30 words.
Wow.
Learning how to do grounding something in a reality, but also to satisfy my inner need to be kind of lyrical. I like flat language as a starting place, but I don't like to stay there. I think poetry is a heightened state.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy that about it. I like language. I like the feel of it when I'm writing it. I like the feel of it when I'm reading it aloud. I like it to be kind of chewy. But it's been an ongoing process, and it continues. It's internalized at this point. So hopefully when it's working, and when it isn't, I don't sit down and think about it anymore. It's kind of how I approach it now. Because of the few years of really, this kind of woodshedding, short pieces, which allowed me to kind of build back up. So where the poetry is now, in the book, you can see it's very long line, very baggy. And when looking at some of the earlier poems, the earliest poems are from my 20s, you still have that shorter line, which doesn't play into the book so much anymore. Continues to evolve. Okay.
Yeah. So actually, I was wondering, could I request a reading or a sample of
sure.
And in particular, one that kind of hit hard for me is on page 33, the photograph of Jay Dantry at the entrance to Jay's bookstall.
Okay, sure. Speaking of long, baggy poems.
Yes.
Okay. Here we go. The photograph of Jay Dantry at the entrance to Jay's bookstall. I worked at Jay's for 10 years. A memory of that.
Oh, wow.
Your standard issue khakis crisp at the street corner, and all the young men around. The shadows of aircraft are small ghosts that play on the ground. In your eyes, the same as ever, betrayed the memory of an old joke. The joke you would still tell as a sign of love. Where have those dance halls gone? That music that held you together so far from home. We never truly appreciate we should. Harry said, your last words were, that you must have known, even in the fog of successive strokes, I'm sorry, it's something I'd never known to see. I still walk past the old storefront. They sell lottery tickets and loose tobacco. They've refurbished the whole place and it's clean and well lit, and there's no old man at the counter to tell you a joke or toss you out on your ass, according to his name. No porno mags, no Shakespeare. No photos of the famous keeping your company. No more glorious mess. It was the mess more than anything that confirmed you were alive. The 100 times the splinter from the broken window frame stabbed your palm. The endless parade of cockroaches, brazen enough to loiter in the open. Every time you ran up the basement stairs and dust rained down from the rafters. Each afternoon, salad oil stained your head. You were alive. We were all so very much alive. The city was gray and dull and filled with ugly snow, but our breath in the air was proof we were, in fact, here. Now that you are not here, I am sorry to you. Winter is just about over, but I can still see the pale play of my breath lingering in your voice, telling me I am here. The shadows of the neighborhood trees in my shitty mood are only a hint of those ghosts, almost solid on the tarmac and ready for flight, ready with a terrible joke. And later, the music already striking up in your ears, the arms of young strangers waiting, the world as I will know it years and years from then.
Wow. That's amazing.
You like that? That poem took a long time, right?
I'm sure it did.
Years of trying to figure out an approach. Because I don't write about work very much, you probably noticed.
Yeah.
One of my go-to things. I really wanted to memorialize Jay in an honest way.
Yeah, and you did it so well. I remember the first time I went into Jay's bookstall.
Did he yell at you? Did he throw you out?
He did not throw me out, but I at the time was a grad student and had just fallen into the world of literary theory and literary criticism. And so I was sort of meandering around the store, and I'd already had a modest stack in my hand. And I said to Jay, he asked me if I could help him find something, or he could help me, you know, find something. And I said, oh, yeah, well, you know, do you have any literary criticism? And he looked at me and said, do you have access to a time machine? Because I haven't sold any of that shit in 30 years.
Yep. That was Jay.
And that was honest and real and snapped me out of my bullshit and was kind of glorious in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, one thing that people will always remark to me on in their memories of that shop were all the pictures that Jay had picking up on the front counter with other writers.
Yes.
But the picture that really stood out to me was the one of him in the service, which hung right next to the door as you were going. Him and his class, with Jeff Cathy, because that was a guy I never got to know him today, much later in life.
Yeah.
But he was a character. He had a lot of stories and a lot of jokes. He's another guy that just rip you apart. You know, one word, he could tear you down.
So,
when you knew he really loved you, it was a special thing. I love that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and I think to go back to that sort of first point of you know, is making about, like, what's so impressive about these poetry is that there is this, these intersections of time and emotional register that happen.
Yeah, it is what I strive for. I'm trying to make some kind of emotional connection with the reader, whether they have similar experiences or not. You know, I just want to kind of reach into their hearts a bit.
Yeah, and I think also, too, you know, it is, I'm thinking even about the poem that faces that poem in the book, Pouring Ketchup from a Fresh Bottle of Heinz 57.
Yeah.
Which, you know, also does not have that, you know, that historical, emotional intersection that a lot of the poetry does, but it is also incredibly Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's one where this part was the title.
Yeah.
I spend enough time at bars with a bottle of ketchup on the counter watching people who might be new in town, who don't know exactly how to pour the ketchup out of a fresh bottle, and they just whack it and whack it and whack it, and then it comes out. There's a trick.
There is a trick, and if you buy the book, you will know the trick. Yeah. So then the other thing I think to talk about and discuss, so yeah, so this is new and old poems, and you did talk about, because I noticed too, I mean, you know, when we go to that second half of the book, was that, what was in the decision making in terms of what you chose from the back catalog, and was there some concern that, you know, your poetry has evolved stylistically to, you know, and go back to the old stuff and in terms of, like, preserving the feel of the collection?
There's a couple of determining factors. When I was putting this together, it was really right after my son was born.
Mm.
During that kind of period where it was all about his relationship with my wife, Anna. I was just kind of around helping.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was all about what she was giving him in that time together. So I actually had, you know, about a week or so where I actually had some free time.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Anna's parents staying with us at the time, and my mom was down the street. So we had a lot of hands on deck. I had a bit of time. Put something together, and I put together, there's probably three versions of this book.
Oh, wow.
Put together due to, you know, all publishers have what they want and what they ask you for as far as manuscript length. So the original idea behind the first section of the book was it was going to be two chapbooks, two very separate chapbooks. But I managed to come up with a sequence of those poems that seem to work organically to me as a single book. And then when I needed to pad it out to create a larger piece of work for some publishers, that's when I decided to come in selected to try that. I had done a selected poems before with Six Gallery Press way back when. My first book with them, King Everything, is essentially a selected poem. And all of that work comes from books I would put together on my own to, like, the five friends that actually cared about what I was writing. So I would, you know, go to Kinko's, make books, and pass them home.
Oh, wow.
10 times. So that King Everything was selected. So when I approached this, I didn't want to duplicate that book. But that book, putting that together, was, it informed the process. Because when I put both of them together, those two kind of selected together, I want the work to come into line with one another.
Mm.
So I always go back. I don't cut and paste so much as I go back and retype.
Oh, wow.
And make decisions as I'm retyping everything as to what makes sense style-wise.
Mm.
So there aren't these crazy jumps from one method or sound of writing to the next. And that kind of informed how I put this together. I chose material I thought spoke to the newer poems. And if you were reading it straight through from the selected portion into the new book, the new poems made sense.
Yeah.
You never got derailed style or subject line. Thematically, it all kind of felt organic to me. It made sense as a complete book. And I gave it to a few people to read to make sure that I wasn't just off my rocker there, that it actually did make sense as a complete book. Scott Silvey was a huge help in that. Michael Sims at Vox Populi also read through early versions of the book. So they were incredibly helpful to make sure it was readable, which is what I wanted it to be. The other sort of informing factor of the larger book, certainly Kung Fu Treachery Press, who put this out, is not from Pittsburgh, and they're the first press for me to work with outside of the state, much less the city. And I felt that it made sense to do a new and selected, on the off chance that people who had never read my work before or seen me read or whatever picked it up, that it gave a fuller picture of the work for people in West Pennsylvania. So all of that kind of played into how the book got put together. And thematically, the new stuff is all about the birth of my son and the Trump election. Those are the two major factors in how those poems came together.
Which is quite the juxtaposition. And actually, if I could ask you to read This Vicious Year in a moment.
Oh, sure.
But actually, can I go back to rewind the tape to something you said about the not cutting and pasting, but retyping?
Yes.
Did you find yourself making edits to, and we're recording this through a phone line, but also doing a video chat, and I'm about to make scare quotes in the air, edits to finished poems then?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't consider any poem finished. I will feel free to edit these things any way I choose. Changing words, changing line breaks, changing stanza formation, every time out. And every time I do a reading, I will change things on the fly as I need.
Wow. And I think that...
I am certainly open to it in the moment if I change something or if I miss a line or a word. I'll quickly come up with something else to slot in the metric of the line.
Yeah.
But I don't feel it anything.
That's wonderful, and I thank you for sharing that. I think it's a public service for people who write poetry. I know sometime in my 20s, I got to meet Donald Hall at a conference, and I, for a long time, was, you know, either very precious. I mean, I was coming out of the 90s, and of course, in the 90s, you know, everybody took, you know, that Allen Ginsberg phrase that he didn't even follow, you know, first thought, best thought, don't revise, which probably, you know, ruined Gen X poetry for a couple decades.
Yeah. It's also a lie.
Yeah, it is absolutely a lie. And to hear him talk about, yeah, how his readers' copies of anthologized poems, he was still making edits.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows maybe to be... Do you find that it allows you to be less precious about?
Yeah. I'm not as tough as I was when I was younger about it being correct, and I feel I'm more relaxed about just kind of letting it fly and, again, seeing where it goes. Knowing that I can change it any time I want. Nobody is looking over my shoulder. I'm not getting phone calls in the middle of the night people ask me why I changed a word and a line from a poem from this version to that version. Nobody's really policing me, so why not take advantage of that? Make it what I want in the moment. You know, you are your own first audience. Pleasing yourself, surprising yourself. I think those are very important. I think that's one of the great things about the form and the art and poetry is it lends itself in its compactness to continually surprising the writer as well as the reader.
What a lovely anarchist notion. But yeah, if we might, could we hear this vicious year?
Sure. So this used to be the title poem, and it was not new and selected. This was the title poem, but that got changed because it didn't make sense anymore. Mm. and it's also very hard for me to say it correctly, which is one of the reasons that I like throwing myself curveballs when I know I have to read something and I can't read it correctly, unless I'm really kind of paying attention or likely to fuck it up.
Oh.
It relaxes my nerves about reading, but oh, I'm going to screw this up no matter what. So some of the lines are kind of tongue-twisty, and that's kind of why they end up that way. But keep me on my own toes. Never be complacent when I'm reading aloud.
Wow.
Hopefully. Okay, you don't need to know.
Now we do.
Year. That's a slowdown. This vicious year. Perhaps when we are gone, we will enter into the beautiful history, as O'Hara called it. But I fear it's vastly more likely our current civic disgraces will forever keep the door barred. All the coins I hoard that never find the palm of an outstretched hand. Every daub of color, so indistinct and ill-defined, the museum goer never notices. Every clear sky day, you can't be bothered to look. It all goes on cosmic budget. I may be lousy at math, but even I can see how the tally goes against me. Here in the darkness and anonymity, I am comfortable. This jukebox here, brim full with throbbing, inconsolable hearts, is the badge on the breast of our better grace. Patsy Cline and Ronnie Van Zandt may have punctuated their lives in the breakage of gravity, but nightly we listen as they rise, hit the heaviness of the day with them. Billie Holiday plants a bloody, endless forest and demands we climb our way out. Up there, we loose a torrential rain of tears, but who's to say the resultant flood isn't cleansing? And Elvis. The common belief is the universe is cold and empty, and this speck of dust is the only game. And what have we done with this mathematically improbable honor? What will you do with the next hour, the next day? Here in this bar on such an ugly night in this vicious year, whose will be the next taking voice? The last, absolutely precious thing we can all be on.
Wow. And yeah, will there still be poems after Trump's no longer president?
And I, honestly, I don't like political poems. I've never tried to write political poetry before. I find a lot of it kind of rampy.
Yeah.
I never cared for it, but yeah, you know, Scott Silsby, who, you know, great poet, you both know. Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about this. Neither of us really engaged very much on the page politically. But you can't, there's no avoiding it. There's no way not, for it not to find its way into the fabric of your work. If you are at all cognizant of the world, your place in it, and yourself as an artist of some sort, or as a witness, which writers are, you're kind of, you're stuck with it. The hope is that, for me, that I approach it in such a way that it's on a human scale.
Yeah.
And that it's not, I'm not preaching at anybody, for the most part. Just kind of documenting how it feels right now. It doesn't feel good. I worry about the world that my son's in and everything that. Largely, the point of this book, why it's dedicated to them, I wanted to give them a way of knowing me.
Mm-hmm.
A way to understand who I was, maybe. Because you never know how father-son relationships are going to go. I've had a difficult relationship with my father.
Yeah.
Many years where we didn't speak.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I know him as well as maybe I should, and I don't want my son to have that in his life. I want him to know me as I'm here, but also as how I wrote what I was thinking during this time. It's something I want to give him, if nothing else. I want him to have that, an idea of who I was.
Wow. And I think, yeah, that is one of the things you're capturing, or you know, that poem captures, and certainly what you're saying, I think, captures one of the really remarkable things about your poetics, and this book in particular, is the way that almost it feels like everything we do right now is flavored by, influenced by, that there's this ambient awareness of this sort of low-key anxiety. You know?
Yeah, it's, there's no going back. Once he's gone, he'll be gone eventually.
Yeah.
And his children will be gone. But the red line, the line in the sand that we went over, there's no going back. It's not like there's this idea, and you know, I talk about it too sometimes. Like, oh, once things get back to normal after the coronavirus hopefully died down and you know, the vaccine, people back to normal. There's no going back to normal. There's whatever's going to come next, which is hopefully better than what we're in right now. But there's no going back.
Yeah.
An illusion that I think I placate myself with sometimes. But it is an illusion.
So does that feeling then influence the way you think about the poems in this collection then, as maybe...
Yeah, it's certainly, like I said, you know, I... when you're in writing workshops, I don't really recommend writing workshops, but they work for some people. One of the things you hear a lot is imagine your ideal today. Who is your ideal? Who are you writing for? And honestly, for I think most of us, our ideal readers is ourselves. We know all of our index. We know the references. So we are the ideal reader for our work. But that can make for very inside baseball poetry.
Mm.
Doesn't connect to other people. As I said, when I was much younger, the sort of thing I wrote. For me, at this point, my ideal reader, who is in my head reading this stuff, is my son. And what do I want him to know about me, about this world, about people I knew?
Mm.
He is the reader. It is what I'm leaving behind specifically for him. That doesn't mean that I don't want other people to engage with it. I don't want to reach other people. I do. Certainly in the reading environment, that's how I approach it. I'm just trying to connect with the people in the audience, whether on the page or on the stage of the reading. But really, ultimately, this is all about me, now, him. It's very clarifying.
Yeah.
Not something I really expected in Appalachia. I was late in my 40s.
Yeah.
But it really reset kind of everything.
Wow.
Yeah. Certainly for me.
Which I think also brings up, another thing that I want to talk about, maybe before we move on to the bottom five, is the number of poems when you talk about, your son knowing the people and the sort of ideal reader and the fact that this book is now out in the world. How many poems list someone as that it was written for, or was written after?
Right. And a lot of that was that kind of, as I mentioned earlier, the two chapbook theory of what I was writing.
Mm-hmm.
One of which was more about the present moment, and the other was about responding, writing poems that responded to other writers that I read. Those were the two books that kind of got sandwiched together. So, yeah, a lot of those poems you were that are dedicated to other writers, and when you ask, what is this part? Most of those poems, if they're dedicated to that writer, it's because I was reading that writer at the moment that I wrote the poem.
Mm.
And I kind of had their poetic world inside of me at the moment that I was writing. And trying to respond to that. And yeah, that's where all that came from. It was a prompt. in workshop talk, it was a prompt.
Yes. Which leads me to, can I just request one more poem, maybe one that I want, and then maybe one or two that you absolutely want to read?
Sure.
I was wondering if we can go to Dreaming Still for Carl Hendricks on page 20.
Yeah. we all love Carl.
Mm-hmm.
Dreaming Still. Sharing a few beers as the dusty half-light drooped in from Penn Avenue, I failed to see the crack, a sliver of blood-red thread that would soon open like fault lines, unexpectedly disastrous. This continent split, rent in two, leaving the living to helplessly watch you in your funkadelic t-shirt, now captain of an unsteerable wreck. Here, we float on, foolish and diminished. The horizon looks injured, fully and sucker punched. We all suffer in the absence. The bruise spreads up my arms into my wife's dreams. In her waking life, she watches as I fade into the words that lead nowhere, foraging for language to sustain us as we move together in silence. Someone say something. Please. Say, I am still dreaming. challenging or ill. Say his dream is done. Say his name. Say he is here. Please say this calm has done a thing with it all. Yeah, and this calm.
I miss Carl too. Yeah.
I was talking to Reed Beebe a few days ago, a couple weeks ago actually, about this collection for the City Paper, and he brought up kind of nostalgia that went his way through a lot of these poems. And I don't consider myself very nostalgic in general, but for this collection, yeah, it's thematically looking at it, like, yeah, there's a lot about the past and the people who are gone. Which again, I didn't set out to write it that way, but I think that knowing that I was writing a lot of this stuff for my son informed that and created that. I don't want to stay away from that stuff. You're right in the moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, looking back, became a big part of it.
Well, and I think, though, for me, nostalgia, I don't know if that's the right word, or at least how I feel the poems when I read them, but
yeah.
It's more that it's about history and you know, this awareness of history and environment that just informs these poetics, yeah. That said, can we flip the record? What's a poem from here that you would like to read for us?
Well, I could read maybe one or two. I'll read the Rumpelwood for you since that's the title.
Absolutely.
I'll end with that one. But I'll read, The River for Huff, that's okay? Maybe.
That's wonderful.
Okay. Every now and then, I think all writers do this, you write something that kind of almost gets that platonic ideal of what you want a poem to do and sound like, and then you just kind of end up reading those at every reading that you do.
Mm-hmm.
The River for Huff is one of those. Interesting to me, I don't know if anybody else could care, but what I noticed when long after the book came out, that The River for Huff, which starts the new poetry session, really is a mirror of a poem for Jeff, who is far away, which starts the selected poem session. It seemed to me very much the same poem. Written 25 years apart. they kind of have that same floating quality to me that I like, but they also address the same issues. And I didn't realize that until looking at the book a few days ago. Oh, those are kind of the same poem.
Happy accident.
Really, write the same poem over and over. But I will read A River for Huff. This is for Albert Huffstickler. A poet who passed away a while back. I think of you often when the coffee's cool, and though this cup is chipped and the country itself gone to hell, I do believe poets belong everywhere and can do some good. I believe it's a needle stuck in every heart stems from the words first sharpened by poets in small, doorless rooms. You say you were only looking for a way out, mistaking your pen for a key. I say we never make mistakes. Today my wife has left me with a pot of the dark stuff, two caps, and a bottom of me. She asked for the river, and so the river is here. In winter, we watch its stillness from the window. Have you ever seen a frozen river from this distant house? It's the spike, readying to strike the silence in your chest. The first word that pierces the heart. The first good thing every day. Also, I didn't realize how often I used the river as an image until I put the book together. There are a lot of rivers in this book.
Well, we're a very wet city, so. Yes, please.
Okay. I was thinking about this poem since it was republished on Jerry Jazz's website a couple of days ago. How different this poem feels to me now than it would have a month ago. It just seems to. It's one of the things that really beautiful about reading poems and getting to write them is how they change without you having to do anything. They go off and live their own lives once you've had your way with them. And they say different things when they come back to you. And this one definitely says something different these days. The rump roller. There is a great banging coming from inside the brewery. While out here in the sun, my blood knocks at the blue ceilings of my veins, like an irate tenant in the apartment one floor down, unprepared for that first blast of Hugh Morgan's trumpet as the rump roller kicks off its assault on the funk-deprived asses of the street. The outdoor benches are bare of shade, and the spring-shocked trees of Allegheny Cemetery, absent their green regalia, stand there, stupid. God damn. What's really gonna happen? The winter has donned its shabby hat and shown itself the door. They arrive like Romero's hungry children, the sun and this last day of March crawling around their faces, ready for renewal, eager for specs and the gauzy, delinquent decisions of warm days, the warmer, more spectacular. A nod is all we need to say, we survived. The world didn't end. That's not a guarantee. Touch my hand. Put your hand to my cheek. I am so happy to see you again. The sun is shaking its beautiful fat ass all across the sky. Etiquette demands we do the same.
That's so good. That beautiful fat ass line I just love, but yeah. There'll still be poems and people will still come back, right? And on that happy note of stunned silence, I think it's now time for the bottom five. Bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready, Christopher?
Sure.
All right, question one. What is a historical event you wish you could have witnessed?
Listening to a lot of Grateful Dead and Allman Brothers records lately, so I'm going to go with the Watkins Glen show, 1973, with them and the band. That would have been kind of cool. A lot of 500,000 people were at that show, so in all the current isolation, I actually wouldn't mind being surrounded by 500,000 people there.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Question two. Are you prepared at this time to aid an escaped prisoner?
My attic is clean and ready to go.
Fantastic. Okay, 500,000 people, sure, but question three is about, it's really more prompt. Tell me about a sublime performance you witnessed that had a very small audience.
I've seen a lot of really great shows, and a lot of great readings. Hard to narrow that down. I will say that, speaking of personal history and a little bit of nostalgia, right around Christmas, the local band, The Affordable Floors, played a show down in Lawrenceville at the remodeled Thunderbird. I used to go see The Floors play Graffiti very regularly in my teens and 20s. It's a very, one of those things that we did with my friends back then. You go and get sweaty in that very smelly rock club. The club where I did my very first reading ever was at Graffiti.
Oh, wow.
So seeing The Floors again, who hadn't played a show in about, I don't know, I think 20 years, 15, 20 years. And a lot of middle-aged folks with smiles on their faces listening as they kind of made their way through an old set. It was great. It just felt really good to revisit that, not as a, God, I wish I was 16 again or some nonsense like that, but just as a, we made it, got this far, this music still sounds good to me, and these guys are still getting on a stage, even though they went away and had their own lives for how many years. It just felt, it reminded me how art lives outside of the people who make it, and that time sustains it, and so does our memories, and experiencing again, creating a new memory. Kind of understanding of what I was looking at when I was 16, 18 years old. So it wasn't the best performance I'd ever seen by them. They were a little rusty, but it meant a lot. So I'll go with that.
Awesome. Question four. Do you experience the pathetic fallacy when looking at objects?
Maybe, I don't know, you tell me. I write about objects, so yeah, I don't know.
Ooh.
Mr. Literary Criticism Guy.
Oh, threw it right back at me. No.
Okay.
I would say no. I would say your poetics are more historically, eco-poetically grounded. That's what I'll say. All right.
That's the right answer.
Yeah. All right. So question five. We're almost through the woods here. Question five. What professional athlete do you identify with most emotionally?
John Stockton, who was playing with the Utah Jazz. He's a smaller guy, but he's out there. He knew how to pass the ball. He's a musician on the court. And I love guys that can move the ball up and down, and aren't flashy, and you know, the big scorers. Jason Kidd was another guy who certainly had a problem off the court, but I always admired the way he pushed the ball down. really made the team and through the group of musicians playing. How good was Stockton? I always loved watching that guy play.
Fantastic. So, I think that's about it. Again, The River is a different kind of prayer, available through White Whale Books, City of Asylum Books, and of course, the corporate giant book-selling Borgs. There'll be links on the website. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com, and so unfortunately named. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and maybe with all this time at home, I'll remember to upload these to Mixcloud. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thank you to Andrew Fox for the amazing theme music. Thank you again to our guest, Christopher Collins. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor.
It's great. This is the first time I've done this show so well.
Yeah, solo, and here we are doing it through the phone, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe someday we'll do it in this room I'm in.
I hope so.
Yes. And again, River is Another Kind of Prayer. Buy it from a local bookstore. Some of them are shipping free. I'll have links on the website. Later, Meech.